Well, up next, a little surprise for you that we'll get into in a minute on Coast to Coast AM. Well, in a little more than a month, we'll be approaching Ghost to Ghost, Halloween time. It's that great part of the season. I love October, November, and December. I really do. That's the favorite time of year for me. But I want you to think right now that wherever you might be, cuddled up in bed, driving, and you do know there's someone in the back seat looking at you. It's going to be one of those nights, one of those hours. We're going to chill you. Going live to London with the greatest storyteller ever born, Lionel Fanthorpe. Hello there, my friend.
Hello. How are you?
You are going to scare people tonight. That's your mission. Your mission. Oh, what's new?
Well, yesterday was a great day for us, the 7th of September. We celebrated our 58th wedding anniversary.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Patricia and I were married in 1957, and we've just clocked up our 58th year together.
Well, on behalf of everybody here at Coast to Coast, Lionel, happy anniversary and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
That's great. You know, that doesn't happen anymore.
It's rare, sadly. And, you know, we are as much in love as we were 58 years ago.
That is magic, my friend.
Yeah, we're really just so much to be thankful for. She's an absolutely wonderful little lady. I'm the luckiest man who ever lived.
Good for you. Well, the luckiest man who ever lived, you are also the greatest storyteller who ever lived. And what has been for you, because as we approach the Halloween season in another month and a half and we get really into it, what has been the stories that really chill you, Lionel, that you've carried with you forever?
Yeah, well, one of them, because as you know, I'm an East Anglian from the far side. I'm living in Wales now, but I was born on the far side of England in a county called Norfolk. And in the next county south of Norfolk, which is Suffolk, there's a village, or a small town really, called Bungay. And in the year 1577, there was a violent electric storm raging through the town. People were taking refuge in the church. And suddenly the lightning, the thunder, and it really was phenomenal, crashed into the church. Two men who had gone up into the belfry to ring the warning bells to say that this storm was there to warn the fellow townspeople were struck dead by the storm. And then there were witnesses in the church that day who said that a huge black dog, enormous thing, with blazing red eyes, had accompanied the storm and attacked people as it raced through the church. And then out again on the far side. And a similar story was told that the neighboring little town, only about 10 miles away, called Blytheborough, where again there were witnesses who said that this huge black dog had come in and people had been seriously injured. Now, it's never been explained. And yet, we know that if we were sitting in the middle of a storm like that, you could see things that aren't there. It's just the way the human mind works. And a flash of lightning or a great black cloud seen through a shattered window can be, can assume the shape of a living being. But the black dog of Bungay, still unexplained after, what, nearly 500 years, still remains a mystery. The people could simply have been killed by the electrical effects of the storm. But it has lived on in that town, and they've even got a town sign with a big black metal dog on the top of it to make sure that it never dies out of human memory. That's one of the most gruesome and horrifying stories. What if it was some strange entity from that? They sometimes referred to them as hellhounds or devil
That's
dogs,
right.
As if it was, the devil himself. Another story I would love to share with you. I've been doing some research recently with Patricia on the new book that we hope to have out before the end of the year.
What is this, book number 200?
It'll be close to that. it's going to be called Padfoot, and it's all about these strange black dog stories from, well, not only from all over the UK, but all over the world. And when we were researching it, I would have said this was a mystery which our listeners would be interested to try to solve or to put forward theories for. There's a church in the little village of Gatcombe, which is on the Isle of Wight, which is just south of England. It's one of our big naval bases down there. And there's only a narrow strip of water between the mainland and this big island, which is, a wonderful holiday resort. But in this village of Gatcombe, there is a church dedicated to Saint Olav, who was a Norwegian saint. And the story is this. One of the principal families on the island, the Esters, that's Esters, who have been a sort of prominent on the island for centuries. This was in the time of the Crusades, so we're back in the 13th century. And Edward Ester, who was a hero and a warrior and a knight, had volunteered to go over and join in the Crusade at Alexandria. Now, he had a very beautiful girlfriend whose name is the name that's unforgettable, Lucy Lightfoot.
And love that.
makes you think she was a great dancer. Anyway, she's described as having very long and beautiful black tresses and was a really excitingly beautiful young lady. And they were so much in love that she went over as far as Larnaca with him. He insisted that she stayed there and not get any closer to the fighting. And he went on to the Battle of Alexandria. Now, during the battle, Edward received a very bad head wound, which he didn't die, but it left him with total amnesia.
Oh.
They got him back to Britain, having left poor little Lucy at Larnaca, and she, good, loyal, faithful lady, waited and waited. And we're thinking 13th century, when communication is not even one millionth of what we've got today. And after 3 years waiting on Larnaca, she assumed that her beloved Edward had been killed and married one of the local fishermen and never came back to the UK. Now, we jump a period of 500 or 600 years, and we come to a date in June in 1831. And we're still on the Isle of Wight in Gatcombe, Church of St. Olave's. In the church, there is a beautiful memorial carving of Edward Ester. He has a little dog at his feet, and there's an angel just above his shoulder. A girl, now remember, we're 500 or 600 years different. A girl comes into the church, local girl, whose name, coincidentally, is Lucy Lightfoot.
Wow, what are the odds?
indeed. And she sits, and the other villagers notice this, she sits staring at the statue of Edward Ester. One day, again, just as we spoke of that terrible storm that hit Bungay and Blythburgh when the black dog legend began there, a similar storm, a very powerful electric storm, hits the area around Gatcombe on the Isle of Wight. Lucy is riding, this is the 19th century Lucy, 1831, is riding her horse towards the town. The storm is so bad, she gallops to the church ties the horse up safely under the eaves on the hitching rail, and goes into the church. Now, this is the girl who has sat looking at the statue of Edward Esther, and she is never seen again.
Never?
Never seen again. She vanishes. Now, what have we got here? Is it time travel? Is it a switch between one probability track and another? And there are all kinds of strange tales about this legend. There was one of the local clergymen who was there in the 1960s who said that, no, it's not true. I just made it all up. It's not real. But you and I, in our investigations of the paranormal and the secret, have come across more than one guy who has tried to dispose of a secret that he did not want continued by pretending, and there was a lot of this going on at Rennes-le-Château when we were investigating down there with the priest's treasure.
Is that a scary place?
Rennes-le-Château?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes, it's very, very weird down there. We were among the pioneers there, and we were there, back there in the 70s, when it was first mooted that the priest, you know, Béranger Saunière, had found this mysterious treasure, or had become immensely rich. And when he finally died bankrupt and in debt in 1917, nobody knows where that treasure came from. And the number of stories that came out of Rennes-le-Château. Yeah, do you want me to just run over the basic bits of that?
Yeah, we've got some time.
Okay, well, it started off that I was then lecturing for the extramural board at Cambridge University over in East Anglia. And we were doing a course on the psychology and sociology of unexplained phenomena. And we needed a new mystery for each of my weekly lectures. And we heard that some guys had been exploring in Rennes-le-Château, and that there was a mystery of a priest. They called their introductory program The Priest, the Painter, and the Devil. Anyway, it was the midsummer holiday coming up, so Patricia and I took the children over to stay with my mother, who was delighted to have them. They were very small and great fun in those days. And we took the kids over to mother, and then Patricia and I set off to the south of France, to Rennes-le-Château, which is close to Carcassonne. And when we got there, we got the full story about Béranger Saunière. He'd gone there round about 1880 as an impoverished village priest with a stipend of about $3 a month. And even if you've got generous parishioners, you're not going to get fat on $3 a month.
Not at all.
And suddenly, this guy who had been living very frugally starts to spend money as if there is no tomorrow. And people who'd invited him to have a glass of goat's milk and a slice of bread and cheese just to keep him alive suddenly found they were being invited back to the presbytery with him, and that he was laying on a 5 or 6 course meal with wine between every course. He was spending money like a king. And the church, which had been dilapidated, leaking roof and problems with the windows, birds flying in and out of holes in the walls, he spent a fortune restoring the church, filling it with beautiful statues and paintings. And it's estimated that he spent at least $4 million over the next few years. Whatever he had found, whatever he had got, seems to have been connected with the Habsburgs of Austria, who had at one time, you know, the Austro-Hungarian Empire of that period. They had once been the wealthiest and the most important people in Europe. And there was a bank account opened in the Royal Bank of Austria in his name, and money was apparently coming to him, or some of the money that he got was coming from the Habsburgs. And what he found, well, we've been interested in that for the last 45 years, and we've never come to an answer. But Berenger Sony have found something of immense value, and yet, towards the end of his life, it had gone. And maybe it was because the source of his wealth, when the First World War from 1914-18 hit that part of France, it may have been that his suppliers were on the other side and he could no longer draw funds from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But the great speculation is, what did he find? Now, living in the area at that time, there were a group of religious, well, we call them heretics, but in the nice way. Should we say they were non-traditionalist Christians?
That's safe.
Non-traditionalist, and they were known as the Cathars, and they had a fortress called Montsegur, the secure mountain, and Pat and I have climbed that mountain and looked at the fortress when we were exploring down there, and it's an amazing place. It's almost impossible to capture it if it's even reasonably defended, but when they're enemies were all around them. The Cathars sent four of their best and bravest mountaineers down the side of the mountain, carrying, and these things were never specified, carrying with them the treasures of their faith. Now, what if this was some very, very precious relic, some religious relic? I won't say the Holy Grail or the Ark of the Covenant, but there were other great treasures, such as the two very strange stones which the priests used to foretell the future. These were called Urim and Thummim, and sometime in the remote past, they vanished. What if the Cathars had retrieved these two stones, once used by the Hebrew priests, and had then sent them down the mountain to their friends, the Templars, who were caring for them, looking after them? What if that object or that artifact or part of it was hidden in Rennes-le-Château?
Ah.
And Berenger Saunier eventually found it, and he couldn't sell it to the Vatican because he is a Catholic priest. And anything he finds automatically belongs to the church. But he could have sold it to the Habsburgs, who had once been Holy Roman Emperors. That's just a thought. Now, the other thought ties in with another of our favorite mysteries. You know, when in 1307, the Templars were overwhelmed by Philip IV, Philip le Bel, who attacked the order, they didn't get the Templar fleet, which was hidden at La Rochelle. And there are suggestions that that fleet made its way all the way north, round by the old Viking sea route, and to what is now Canada. And they are the people responsible for digging the Oak Island money pit in Mahone Bay, just off Nova Scotia. There's a lot of publicity there at the moment where some explorers are researching
it
now.
There's a TV show on it now too, Lionel. Indeed. And we're going to take this break, but we're going to come right back with you. I've got to ask you to give us the Spring Heel Jack story all over again. And then I want to know if you've ever heard of a story of someone who went into a barn dance and would dance with women, and they would find imprints of cloven hoofs from him. Ooh, they were dancing with the devil. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Lionel Fanthorpe as well. Lionel, you've got to tell us about Spring Heel Jack.
Well, he's one of my own favorite mysteries, and I'd love to talk to you and our listener friends about him. And he was around about the same period, in his heyday, as Jack the Ripper. So that's taking us towards the end of 19th century, except that where Jack the Ripper's horrible activities took place in London, at the East End of London, Jack with the spring heels appeared in different places all over Britain. And basically, the episodes with Spring Heel Jack fell into two sort of major categories. He would knock on a door, and of course this is the day when nearly everyone had at least one servant, so there'd be a young maid in the house. And this is what whoever Spring-Heeled Jack was looking for. A young girl, teenage girl, in a little maid's uniform would answer the door. And on one occasion, because he was a cunning rascal, he said, "I'm a police officer. We have Spring-Heeled Jack cornered. I'd like you to come around the corner with me, and I'll show you where he is. I need somebody to stand watch while I get another officer." And the poor innocent girl comes out of the door, and the thing that said it was a police officer was Spring-Heeled Jack. And he would grab and assault any girl that he could get his hands on. Now, when, as was to be expected, the poor kids screamed loudly for help, something to be said in favor of Victorian Englishmen was that they would run to the aid of any lady in distress. It was part of the culture. It was part of what a decent man did. And within seconds, there'd be half a dozen burly rescuers rescuing the girl and chasing Spring-Heeled Jack. You can imagine that you're in a cul-de-sac and you think, "We've got him." And there's a 10 or 12 foot wall at the end of the cul-de-sac. And you can imagine you and I and half a dozen other guys, "We've got him. We'll finish him." And suddenly, he takes off almost as if he has a rocket strapped to his spine. There's a tremendous leap, and he's atop of this 10 foot wall. Now, if he'd, assuming that he was human, if he'd wanted to compete in the Olympics, I think he'd have taken every gold medal in every jumping class. And this occurred not only in London, but in various other towns and cities of the UK, that Jack would attack a young female on her own. She would scream for help. Rescuers would appear from everywhere round about. They would pursue Jack. You'd think you'd got him cornered. And Jack would leap an unbelievable height, and as heavy, he could jump from ground level to catch hold of a gutter pipe halfway up a building, and then off over the roof and gone. So this is the great mystery of him. Was he human? Because he could certainly appear human when he wanted to, as in the case where he spoke to the girl and pretended to be a police officer. And on the other hand, something so unbelievable about the power of his legs when he leapt like that makes you begin to wonder, if was he an extraterrestrial? What was he?
You don't think he had an apparatus on his feet, like springs that he would pull a lever or something?
Yes. Now, that, of course, is one of, I think, the best theory. There was even an army unit who, when he was at his zenith, they had an enterprising technical sergeant who asked a number of volunteers to put springs on their boots to see whether he could get, you know, he's in a position where he could tell his men, "Would you like to come and help me with this experiment?" And they tried, with the company blacksmith, they tried various types of spring, and the only result was that one of the soldiers who'd volunteered to help got a broken ankle out of it and was off duty for several weeks. So that it didn't seem, from what this military experiment concluded, that springs of anything that they could devise would actually help. And yet, I think that that idea you just put forward is a very, very good one. It had to be something artificial that was powered by, you know, but how could you arrange a thing like that? Imagine that there were metal boots, like big horse riding boots, or like the knights used to wear on the days of medieval armor.
I mean, they'd have to be tightly wound springs, though, to pop him up that high, right?
Yes, they would. You see, it was when you think of the power-weight ratio, he was apparently quite a big fella, not like the sort of circus athlete who could, jump to an unusual height, because they were normally very lightly built, and their power-weight ratio would enable, shall we say, a spring device of some sort to get them up. Apart from the fact, you say, that Spring-Heeled Jack spoke to people when he'd attack them, another interesting factor was his hands. The girls who'd been attacked, and his usual technique was to go for the girl's neck and rip her blouse open, and those who'd been attacked in that way said that his hands didn't feel like human hands. Ah. They felt more like metal. Now, maybe the spring suit, if that's what the secret was, went all the way down. Are we thinking, is he inside a complete equivalent of a suit of armor, which has got the springs in the leg parts? But those claw-like hands may be a clue. And again, there are one or two even relatively recent reports of things like him that have appeared in Mornin Wood, for instance.
But he looked normal, right?
He looked, yes. I mean, if he came up to, on one occasion, he attacked, as a change from attacking women, he attacked a businessman on his way home from work in the City of London, and he was crossing a park, and this bloke just walked along in the ordinary way, and suddenly went for him, snatched his bag, and leapt away with it out of sight. So that when you saw him face to face, or if he passed you in the street, there would be nothing about him which would cause you to suspect that he was anything other than human. So he looked externally to be a perfectly normal human being. And again, what was his motive? In the case of attacking the businessman, yes, he probably wanted the contents of the guy's briefcase, but the other attacks all seemed to be sexually orientated. He seemed to derive his pleasure from frightening the girls that he attacked, almost as if he was one of those rather nasty characters who'd like to hear a victim screaming with fear. And again, all the theories in the Victorian times included the idea that somebody had trained a kangaroo and dressed it up as a person. Well, you would never pass a kangaroo as a human being. And it would certainly, we used to have the old boxing kangaroos as one of the circus entertainments, but they're not that intelligent. It would be very difficult to pass a kangaroo up as a human being.
You've written a book called Mysteries and Secrets of Voodoo, Santeria.
Yes.
Obia.
Yes, I have, yes.
Pat,
I wrote that a few years ago.
Tell me about voodoo, because I was told that voodoo practitioners are generally good people, and that mainstream media has taken what they do out of context. What have you uncovered?
Well, when we did the research for this book, we came across a great many cases where the voodoo practitioner was a healer, and looked at from another perspective, they could have been seen almost like those unorthodox medics who carry out all kinds of healing work by using different means. And if we think about a voodoo healer, what I think we are coming very close to is the idea of the unexplored power in the human mind. And just to digress for a second, you know that there are some theories about poltergeist phenomena in which the movement of the furniture or of the bedclothes is thought to be a form of telekinesis, but which is coming from the mind of a person who has an abnormal power in that direction and doesn't know they're doing it, that it's done subconsciously. And if we think about the power in our own minds, the things that we can do in extreme circumstances, the rescuer who realizes that there are people trapped in a fire, and he will take a coil of rope and rush through it, and he won't, for a few seconds, he won't feel the flame as he races up to get the rope to the upper window to get the people down. Because there is a motive which is over and above any everyday motive, the human body, under the control of a powerful mind in an emotional frame, can do all sorts of strange things. I mean, I've seen a stage hypnotist, which is another branch of this, get a quite small member of the audience up on the stage, hypnotize the bloke, put his head on one chair, his heels on another, and then invite four members of the audience, having told the hypnotized man that he was a steel girder, not a human being, get four people sitting on him. Well, you could take an Olympic weight trainer and ask him whether he could get four people sitting on his tummy and with his head on one chair and his feet on another.
Not unless he was hypnotized.
Yeah, but that... So that what we don't, I think, always give credit for is the power of the mind once we have, as it were, let it loose. And so we come back to this this whole idea of a voodoo healer having the power to release in his voodoo spells or his voodoo enchantment, he has the power to release the patient's own strength. And strength not only in the muscular, physical sense, but strength in the power of healing. We've come across cases, haven't we, and I'm sure that you have, very much, of people who have felt wanted. Somebody who has got a terrible illness and is thought perhaps to be at risk of dying, and then something comes along which gives this man or woman a motive to live, and it seems to supercharge the immune system, and they recover. You know, when we get cases of miraculous healing, it's as if the mind has told the body to do something different, and I think that is at the back of voodoo healing. It's releasing the power in the patient's mind.
I've got to tell you, the stories that you have given us over the years, Lionel, have been just amazing. But did you ever hear of the one where the guy went into a barn dance and ended up having cloven feet, that the woman was actually dancing with what they thought was Satan?
I haven't come across that, and it's fascinating. Could you tell me a bit more about it?
Well, other than, you know, there was a country dance in the western part of the United States back in the 1800s, and, you know, they would have their little community dance in a big barn. And, right. You know, the guys would be there with their fiddles playing around, and this guy came in and kind of, like, swept away and was able to get dates and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But they noticed that when he was dancing, he would leave little marks on the floor, and he had cloven hoofs.
Now, that is amazing.
What would that be? To me, that's the devil, isn't it?
Well, it certainly sounds like it. And one of the strange things about the character, the entity, who is variously described as Satan or Lucifer or the devil or Old Nick, is that underneath all the evil of which he is the personification, there seems to be something that you and I might think of as a perverted sense of humor. That this is the sort of thing, he'll come in, I will come in. Just imagine sort of putting ourselves inside his head and with that wickedness modified to a slight extent by humor. And he's coming in and he's saying, I'll give them something to think about. And he charms them and he dances with them. And after he's gone, somebody notices the prince and the flock of, my heavens above, I was dancing with the devil. And you could imagine the impact that it would make on the people if we had been at that dance that night with our respective ladies, and this guy comes in, good-looking guy, and suddenly thinks, hey, what's that underneath his trouser bottoms? Are they feet? It is this curious idea of a demonic something which nevertheless has some sort of weird idea of humor attached to it. There's one other little tale, if we've got just a minute.
I've got a minute left for you.
Okay.
Do we have time for that?
Yeah, I'll do my very best. This was the one where the headless coachman drove his coach from Yarmouth to King's Lynn in my native Norfolk, and there had been a particularly vicious poacher called George Mace, who had badly injured a number of gamekeepers. He led the gang of the Wotton ruffians of poachers. And one day, George Mace's body is found at Breckles Hall, and the theory was he'd been given a ride in the Phantom Coach. And the Phantom Coach, as it was done in a poem, the Phantom Coach came down the road and took George Mace away. His body lay at Breckles Hall before the break of day. What really happened to him?
Lionel, my friend, thanks for being on the program again, and the best to you, and happy anniversary one more time.
Thanks again, George. It's always great to be with you. Call me whenever you need me.
Okay, and I can't wait. On Christmas Eve, we'll be live, and of course, we'll be playing your 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. I mean, that's going to be exciting as well, too. Got some great shows in store for you for the entire week. And I wanted to thank all of you for being with us on our Labor Day weekend special shows, where, of course, we always give you a live program on a holiday. For Dan Galante, Gina Salvati, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lottasour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.